This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And a hearty welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program which we call the Big Picture, where we try to unravel things that are happening and make sense of all the data dots that you may run across from day to day. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. Next week, the Fed is going to meet where it is widely expected it will raise interest rates for the sixth time to 1.75%. Ever since hitting a bottom in the summer of 2016, long-term interest rates have steadily risen, and especially risen sharply since last fall. And many experts believe that a new bear market in bonds has begun. So the trillions that are parked in bond fund safe havens are losing money, and they're likely to lose even more. So now you as an investor, if you're heavily invested in bond funds, you're losing money. And today we're going to examine the new bond bear market, what it means, and what it will look like going forward.
You know, I guess when we talk about a bond bear market, John, and we talk about interest rates going up, we got to put this into perspective. What's bringing this all about? Because for most of our listeners, if they've been invested probably the last two or three decades, they've seen nothing but declining interest rates, including the lowest interest rates in recorded human history, which we saw in the summer of 2016, when the vast majority of bonds were not only at their lowest interest rates, but a good majority of those bonds that were being issued at the time were being issued at negative interest rates, meaning that you paid the government to loan them money. So what we've seen recently, economic growth has picked up after remaining subdued for 8 years, and now under Trump, government spending is accelerating. We just saw a massive tax cut, and believe it or not, they're talking about another round of tax cuts is being contemplated on top of infrastructure spending. So we now have stimulus that's being applied at the end of a business cycle, and that is more likely to cause inflation to pick up, which we'll touch upon here in just a moment. But growth in the economy is picking up, and this is what has given the Fed the confidence to move forward with hiking interest rates, because they began, as everybody remembers, they began in 2015. They only raised interest rates one time. Same thing in 2016. They raised interest rates once. So here we are, 4 years into an interest rate cycle. The only time they raised more than once was last year. And they now feel, with economic growth picking up, there is that confidence to go forward with another three rate hikes. And John, let's go with that clip from Powell where he says, "I've gotten more confident on the economy."
My personal outlook for the economy has strengthened since December. And again, each member of the FOMC is going to be writing down a new set of projections and a new estimate of appropriate monetary policy as we go into the March meeting, which begins 3 weeks from today. And so I wouldn't want to prejudge that new set of projections, but we'll be taking into account everything that's happened since December.
That was Fed Chair Powell in his testimony before Congress last time he was on Capitol. Actually, the first time, as a matter of fact, he was on Capitol Hill. So I guess the question, Jim, is why have the rates risen more rapidly in the last 6 months when you consider that the Fed began raising these rates back in 2015 and only recently have the rates really begun rising in the long run?
You know, John, it's not really one factor. It's a combination of factors. Number one, growth. And along with an increase in growth, inflation is picking up. So growth is accelerating in the economy. I mean, it's not hyper growth like we saw in earlier decades. But, you know, when you go from 2% to 2.5% to 2.8% or whatever the figure is going to come out for the first quarter, growth is picking up. We're also seeing a pickup in the inflation numbers in the producer prices paid components. We'll talk about that in another segment in the show today. We're seeing it in producer prices. We're seeing it in a number of places. Secondly, one thing that's happened over the last year, major buyers of government debt from the Fed, China, and Japan are cutting back on their buying. Number three, growth and interest rates are picking up elsewhere, especially in Europe, where the vast majority of negative interest rate bonds were located. And number four, U.S. deficits are accelerating. It's going to be somewhere between $750 to $800 billion this year. Next year, the deficit for 2019, which begins in October of this year, it's expected to hit close to $1 trillion. So in a nutshell, you have more debt coming to the market as a result of U.S. deficits. Number two, you've got big buyers like the Fed, China, and Japan, the biggest holders of treasuries, cutting back. And that was what kept the lid on the upper end of the bond market for so long, was all this quantitative easing. Now, the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of China, and the Bank of Japan are moving from an era of quantitative easing to an era of quantitative tightening. It's beginning with the Fed, the Bank of England, the ECB is cutting back. Bank of Japan has hinted that they may do that next year. So it was all of this quantitative easing that we saw come into play over the last 3 or 4 years since the financial crisis that sort of put a lid on the upward trajectory of interest rates. And then there was a wide disparity between interest rates here and interest rates in Europe, and that gap is narrowing. And so, you know, investors have more places to go for yield, so the U.S. just isn't the only game in town anymore. So we have now moved to quantitative tightening. The Fed, at the end of this month, will increase its reduction of its balance sheet by $30 billion. They've been increasing it every 3 months by $10 billion. It will start next month in April. They'll reduce their balance sheet by $30 billion a month. On an annual basis, that's, you know, $360 billion. The Fed isn't in the market buying. At the same time, the amount of debt the government is issuing is almost doubled from its low of $500 billion a couple of years ago to next year, when it'll be close to $1 trillion. So the big buyers of bonds are cutting back while the supply is increasing.
And I think the thing that probably people are wondering is how high the interest rates will go, because as we wrapped out the week, the 30-year bond closed at 3.1%, the 10-year treasury to 2.9%.
You know, a lot of the technicians, including this week's technician, Ari Wald, think that they can range, depending on who you're talking to, anywhere from 3% to 3.5%. And most of the technicians and the experts we've had on the program, once you start getting above 3.5%, what would cause that would be a perception that inflation is running much higher and inflation has been rising steadily. But once you get beyond 3.5%, you start getting to 4%, we've got problems, both for the bond market, but also for the stock market. So we're seeing prices start to rise. They're rising gradually, but they're increasing now. You're seeing it in the PPI, the CPI, the prices paid component of the ISM, and you're also seeing it in import prices. And a lot of what we've seen in import prices, a lot of that has to do with what we've seen in the U.S. dollar, which has fallen 16% from its highs reached in January of 2017. So right now, if we look at import prices, are up 3.5% year over year. Producer prices are up 2.9% year over year, and CPI is up 2.3%. So we've gone from a very disinflationary environment. We're transitioning towards a more inflationary environment. It's not going to be hyperinflation, but inflation will be increasing. So as long as economic growth continues to pick up and inflation heads higher, the Fed will continue with its gradual rate hikes until they break the markets and the economy.
While many factors shape the economic outlook, some of the headwinds the U.S. economy faced in previous years have turned into tailwinds. In particular, fiscal policy has become more stimulative, and foreign demand for U.S. exports is on a firmer trajectory.
And once again, that was Fed Chair Powell speaking before Congress.
You know, the irony of this, John, is the Fed, at least under Yellen, was always complaining to Congress, hey, we need fiscal stimulus. We can't do this all by ourselves. We finally get economic stimulus at the end of the business cycle, because you normally get it at the beginning. And now the Fed is going and feeling confident enough to start increasing rates. And we know eventually what will happen. Something is going to break. We'll probably see it first in the markets and then eventually with the economy.
So I guess what we're believing here is that the Fed is actually going to follow through with, three, maybe four rate hikes, and that means they're going to continue in this pattern.
You know, when you talk about interest rates, we got to separate interest rates into two categories: short-term rates, which are mainly driven by Fed policy, in long-term rates, which are driven by the bond market. Now, if growth and inflation begin to pick up, you are going to see long-term rates will continue to rise and steepen along with short-term rates, which, by the way, is good for banks because they pay you less money, and the higher that interest rates rise, the more that they can charge on their loans. And we'll get into the second segment of the show today when we take a look at the Senior Loan Officers Survey. It's loosened up lately, and one of the reasons is not only is the economy picking up steam, but also the yield curve is starting to steepen, meaning that banks can make more money when they make loans. But at some point, and I don't know at what point that will be, probably more likely next year, rates will begin to flatten and then maybe invert, and that will tell us we're likely to head into a recession. But right now, John, as we'll talk about in our next segment, all the LEIs are saying it's a go this year, and it's unlikely we are going to see a recession. But we don't know. I mean, the Fed is going in March. The futures market says they'll probably go again in June. After, if they do go ahead in June, will they do what they did last year and say, all right, we just raised rates twice. We've got the Fed funds rate in June with a quarter point hike to 2%. Let's sit back and just see what develops in the economy, which is what they did last year. They waited till December to raise rates for the third time. Will they follow that same pattern this year? A lot of it is going to depend on what happens to not only economic growth, but also to the levels of inflation. The one difference, however, the economy is more fragile today because there's a lot more debt outstanding than when the financial crisis erupted back in 2007 and 2008. In fact, a recent study showing the close correlation between household debt and growth in the economy. Why this is important, 70% of the U.S. economy is consumption. So GDP is driven by consumers spending money. This recent study shows that there is a direct link between household debt, the housing market, and credit expansion. And credit expansion in the household sector is driven through three channels. Number one, credit supply. And I just want to point out, there's a bill that just worked its way through the Senate. It is yet to get passed in the House that would loosen up the channels of regulation on the banking sector, making it easier to lend money. The message coming from Washington to Wall Street, loosen up the purse strings. It's safe to go ahead and take a little bit of risk. The second channel of transmission is as credit is extended to household sectors, whether it's mortgage loans, car loans, home equity loans, credit card loans, whatever it is, that boosts consumer demand. In other words, more goods are bought by consumers. And eventually, however, something happens. And it's usually in the financial sector. Somebody gets into trouble, and all of a sudden, things flip, credit dries up, household spending and demand falls, voila, you're in the middle of a recession. So credit dries up usually when there is trouble somewhere. And we'll talk about the possibility of a financial crisis here going forward, because the politicians and Wall Street would have you believe, as a result of regulation and everything going well, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Nothing is further from the truth, because what politicians tell us today and what will happen in the future are two different things. But right now, the message coming from Washington is to dial up the risk. We're going to start deregulating and undo a lot of the regulation that was put into play after the financial crisis. And John, let's go to that clip of the senator on Capitol Hill regarding this loosening.
10 years ago, the Wall Street almost collapsed our economy. And this body seems to have experienced sort of a collective amnesia. 10 years ago, look what happened to the economy. And today we're giving relief to many of the largest banks in this country. Relief that these things on the stress test, a weaker stress test, a less regular stress test, which will mean many of the larger banks simply won't be under the intense examination that we've done in the past. And what does that mean? What that means is those banks are more likely to jeopardize the safety and soundness of the banking system. Again, we know what happened 10 years ago when we had to bail them out. Mr. President, there is a Washington Post article came out today. The headline is Senate banking bill likely to boost chances of bank bailouts. From the Congressional Budget Office, Senate banking bill likely to boost chances of bank bailouts, CBO says. Why would we do that?
That was Senator Sherrod Brown. He's a Democrat from Ohio. And you know what's really strange about all of this? You become aware of the fact that they just never seem to learn. They just repeat it.
Well, that's what happens. We get into crisis, and then all of a sudden, everybody, you know, they want to make it look like they're doing something. They tend to overregulate. They put in measures, and then all of a sudden, they begin to unwind them as the economy improves, gets stronger, and they go, okay, maybe we're a little bit too strict. And it's not just the banking bill. In fact, in his testimony before Capitol Hill, Fed Chairman Powell confirmed in his testimony it was lightening up on guidelines that limit lending to companies with big debt loans. And that follows a recent appeals court decision that is set to make it cheaper for money managers and to, let's say, bundle corporate loans into bonds, a ruling that could increase the flow of credit for private equity buyouts and other highly indebted companies. So basically, the government is loosening up the reins after companies have gone on, and here's the other thing, a decade-long borrowing spree fueled by the Fed's low interest rate policies. And here's the fact. Outstanding leveraged loans have grown by 70% to nearly $1 trillion since the end of 2007. Junk bonds outstanding have doubled over that same amount of time. So here we are. We're in the middle of a Fed rate raising cycle. Congress is loosening up the lending standards, saying, hey, banks, go at it again and pick up the risk. And meanwhile, the amount of debt has more than doubled, and when it comes to junk bonds, up 70% on leveraged loans. And here we are with the Fed raising interest rates, and we know what that leads to. And it's not just that. We're also seeing the things that you normally see towards the end of a business cycle when things get crazy. The covenant protections that protect bond investors are beginning to weaken, and they have weakened steadily for the last 9 months, according to Moody's in a recent report they issued in January. So what these covenants do is they protect the bond investors from companies doing certain things or issuing more debt or putting the bond investors at jeopardy. Well, companies have found they don't have to do that. They're getting rid of them and lowering interest rates, meaning the spread between what you get on a risky loan and, let's say, safe government debt has narrowed considerably.
Yeah, I'll say it again. Once again, haven't we seen this picture before? This is nothing new.
Yeah, we're seeing the same thing play out. This is, 10 years since we had a crisis erupt. And you know what happens is people tend to forget. I mean, it began in 2007 with Bear Stearns, and it seems like politicians are telling bankers and the public it is unlikely to happen again. You know, the basic feeling is, hey, there's no way a big bank could get in trouble. And, John, the seeds are in place right now for another financial crisis. Maybe not a big bank going under because they're better capitalized today. They're more liquid. They've been restricted. But, if we take a look at crises, debt is much bigger today at all levels, consumer level, corporate level, government level. Two, covenants are disappearing from bond offerings, meaning protection is being taken away for bond investors. Number three, interest rates, even though they're rising, remain historically low. Number four, as we just heard from that senator, regulations are being loosened. Number five, in the background of all of this, the Fed has begun another rate raising cycle, which has picked up steam. It's no longer raising interest rates once a year. Now they're talking three times, possibly four times this year.
So now let's drag this over to the subject of investing. What does it mean for the bond markets? What does it mean for investors?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at J.P. Morgan did a study on what happens to various bond classifications, bond funds with a 1% increase in interest rates. Now, remember, 1% doesn't sound like much, but if you go from 2% to 3%, that is a big deal. Percentage-wise, that's a 50% increase versus if we were at 6% going to 7%. So the damage done in terms of principal destruction is much greater because the rates are much lower. So according to JP Morgan, if interest rates go up 1%, on treasuries, you would see 2-year treasuries, nothing. On 5-year treasuries, you'd see a loss of 2.3%. On TIPS, 3.1%. On 10-year treasuries, and you're already seeing this reflected in one of the popular ETFs, a 6% loss. On 30-year treasuries, a 15% loss. If you look at other bond categories, floating rate bonds, they would actually make money. In other words, they would go up, just like an adjustable rate mortgage. Adjustable, high yield bonds would lose 4%. Mortgage back would lose a little over 5%. Collective bonds in general, which is high yield, regular yield, that would be closer to 6%. Munis would lose close to 6%. And investment grade corps would lose about 7%. And that's one reason why, for our clients, we are using floating rate bonds, because as interest rates rise, their income rises and their total return rises. Think of if you have a mortgage and you have adjustable rate mortgage, what happens when the Fed starts raising interest rates? The bank begin to increase your mortgage rate. Well, it's the same kind of thing with a floating rate bond, which is one reason we like them. So instead of losing money when rates go up, you actually make more money and more income because the interest rate on the bond is adjusted upward. The interesting thing is JP Morgan also highlighted the default rates, which are very low right now, which you would expect when the economy is doing well and the economy is expanding. There's less risk of a default. The average default rate is about 3.8%. Currently, it's about 1.3%. So you are starting to see that default rates are low, credit spreads are tight, credit default swaps have been low. So there isn't a lot of risk being priced into the market right now.
So as they continue to raise interest rates, which it looks like they're going to do next week, what does this mean for listeners, Jim, who are invested either in bonds or bond ETFs?
Well, let's take three popular bond ETFs, TLT, which is Treasuries. TLT is down 6.4% from its high, matching the JP Morgan study that shows that a 1% increase would create a 6% loss. LQD, which is corporate bonds, is down 3.4%. And HGY, which is high yield, is down about 1.8%. So the rise in yield, it means bond prices or bond fund prices are falling. And a lot of times it's also sparking, by the way, and this is from Bloomberg, a outflow out of these ETFs and bond funds. iShares, for example, the U.S. aggregate bond ETF, as of last week, hit almost $800 million flow out of that bond fund in a single day. That's the largest one-day withdrawal since its inception, going back to 2003. And what that does, when you get an outflow of almost, close to $1 billion in a single day, that is forcing that bond fund manager to go into the marketplace and dump those bonds. And that sometimes can accelerate selling, as we saw, for example, in those volatility funds that blew up in the crisis, the little correction that we had in beginning in January. So therein lies the problem. We have a concentration of capital in these ETFs and bond funds, and money can leave it very quickly because investors are very fickle. And so that forces liquidation, which can accelerate losses.
Well, you know, people quite often flock for various reasons like security or safety, treasuries, or to municipals. But what you're saying here is if interest rates go up, it's going to affect everybody.
Yeah, I want to focus on another sector of the bond market that is popular with high net worth individuals, and that is municipal bonds, because there's been a number of studies that are being done on credit. Another one just came out with Moody's. And what they did is they did a stress test of the states in the state's ability to handle another recession. Because what they found is the Great Recession from 2007 to 2009 affected states in many ways much greater than recessions in the past. And the other thing that they found is, as a result of it, the states weren't prepared and had to take extraordinary measures from, raising taxes to drastic cutting in spending. I mean, the unemployment rate in local government workers was 750,000 jobs lost during the Great Recession. And to my knowledge, at least in the Moody's report, not all of those jobs have been replaced. So, one of the things that happens in the reality of a recession for a state is, number one, revenues decline. The economy declines along with that tax revenues. Number two, Medicaid expenses accelerate, growing faster than revenues. And number three, Medicaid spending reduces discretionary spending for the state. In other words, the state has to fulfill its Medicaid spending requirements. And what that means is the more money they spend on that, the less money they have to spend elsewhere. And so this was something that Moody's took a look at, And the other thing that they found in this last recession is revenues in a recession impact differently. And one of the reasons that they discovered more and more states are relying on fewer taxpayers. In other words, they're making their tax structure more progressive. So the state is relying on fewer and fewer taxpayers and means of diversifying their tax base to get their tax revenues. So that's more volatile because Larry Lotsibucks, when he go through a recession, he may have less capital gains. He may have less stock options. He has less money. So relying more on income taxes, what we've seen in the last decade is more and more states have put all their eggs in one basket. They're relying more on income tax rates for high income individuals. The other thing they found out too, in order to stimulate economic growth, just as the president just lowered taxes, they create tax incentives for certain states. You'll often hear about a major corporation like Amazon or Walmart or somebody or Boeing. They relocate to a new location, a new state, and the state will come in and say, hey, if you relocate here, build your plant, we're going to give you all kinds of tax benefits. We're going to have no income tax, lower property taxes. We're going to give you a tax incentive because the state knows if the factory is built, that means more jobs, more people getting paid. That's more tax revenues for the state. So in many ways, you have certain sectors of within a state that are not producing tax revenues, and that can also hurt.
You know, I got to ask a question here because it seems like, you know, take the weather. I mean, sooner or later, you know, it's going to rain unless you're in some very strange part of the world where it rarely ever does. But even there, almost every place gets rain sooner or later. We're going to have another recession, more likely sooner than later, given where we are in the business cycle. But you would think that in anticipating this, they'd go, okay, we're headed towards this, so we need some kind of a rainy day fund or something along those lines.
You know, a lot of states do have them, but they're poorly funded because, you know, what are you thinking of when times are good? You're thinking, we don't need to worry about that. Moody said, you know, to really weather a recession where you have revenues declining for over a year before it turns around, states should have the equivalent of about 8.5% of their budget in a reserve fund. But the thing is most of these states, like anybody else, in good times, just like right now, the savings rate is dropping in the country. Well, the savings rate is dropping for states as well. Now, what Moody's did is they took a look at two possible scenarios. One, a moderate average recession, and one, a severe recession. And, you know, even if you look at a moderate recession, the combined fiscal shock, in other words, the percentage of decline of revenues, Alaska, 42%, Louisiana, 27%. And a lot of these states saw a big drawdown. And you take a look at a severe recession, Alaska, almost 67% loss in revenues, Colorado, 26%. If you take a look at Idaho and Illinois, 24 and 19%. Let me see here, 24% in Minnesota. You take a look at North Carolina and South Carolina, 37, 26%. Utah, 18%. So, you know, this can have a major, major impact. And what they did is they took a look at these scenarios and they said, all right, where are these states right now? What is their actual reserves in terms of what they should be? And the best state, believe it or not, even though they get hit the hardest, which is probably why being smart fiduciaries, they have large reserves. Alaska has almost 233% of the required reserves. Necessary reserves are 42% of their budget. They have 232. So Alaska, Wyoming, West Virginia, Texas, Nebraska, Nevada, New York, which was surprising. So you have about 10 states that are in pretty good shape. And then you have kind of iffy states in between. My own state of California is on the borderline of going into a troubled area. They have actual reserves about 5.9%. They need actually 10.7. And then we have 15 states that are in trouble and going to be in trouble. And these range from Connecticut, Arkansas, Arizona, Vermont, Virginia, Kansas, Missouri, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. And I can't believe New Jersey governor wants to raise taxes almost over $1 billion. And we're in good times. Imagine what's going to happen in bad times. Let me see. Who else do we have? Illinois, New Mexico, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and Louisiana. Some of these states are very resource dependent. which is why they may be in trouble. But a lot of these states have big budgets. I know my own state of California is almost dependent on 20% of its revenues coming in from capital gains. I mean, they literally have made a fortune here in Silicon Valley with all these stock options, the social media revolution that took place. They took in a lot of money. I think they made over like $2 billion on Facebook's IPO. What happens in a recession? That stuff dries up. So that is something, John, that I think a lot of well-heeled investors aren't really thinking about right now. And you normally don't. When times are good, you're not thinking about, you know, it's kind of like you're sitting on the beach in Florida. Everything is sunny, but way out there on the weather radar, there's a hurricane that's forming off the west coast of Africa. You don't see it and you don't know when it's going to hit and where it's going to hit. And that's why, you know, you need to take precautions and be prepared, because we know sooner or later we're in a Fed rate raising cycle, and it's unlikely these guys are smart enough to figure it out and take us through a soft landing. They've only done that once in almost 60, 70 years.
So now that we've gone over all of this, what are you doing for your clients, Jim, to prepare your people, their investments for rising interest rates and a new bear bond market?
Well, we're doing a number of things, and it's just like there just isn't one thing you can do in particular. But, you know, since we do individual bonds and things like that, we're using floating rate bonds when we can get a good bargain and buy them at a discount, because every time interest rates are adjusted upward by the Fed, that means the interest rate on these bonds go up. So instead of losing principal, you're actually making more income. The other thing we'll do is we'll have short-term laddered bond portfolios, and we're staying short-term right now. We're not long-term. The other thing that's becoming attractive is Treasury bill rollovers, because think about it this way. Every time the Fed raises, if they raise a quarter point next week, that means T-bills will go up a quarter of a point. We're also using active bond fund managers. There's two in particular that we like who have a track record of weathering these financial storms. And then when it comes to municipals, we're primarily staying to short-term municipal bonds and staying with school district bonds. The reason we like that is we can go into an individual school district and analyze the property tax revenue, so we know what the interest rate coverage is for that bond. Because when you're going in a revenue bond, the safety of that bond is depending on its revenue source. And so when we go in a school district bond, we can look at the property tax revenues, which tend to be less volatile, and that gives us a higher degree of safety. The other thing that we do, and this has been probably one of the most helpful tools that we use, is we use Bloomberg Analytics. And the reason we use that is when you have a bond that is issued by, let's say, a company, or for that matter, a municipality, what will happen if it's large enough, they're going to hire a credit rating agency, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, to rate that bond. But what happened? Let's say the bond was issued 5 years ago. Well, that company or municipality isn't going to hire the rating agencies to come back and re-rate the bonds and pay them hundreds of thousands of dollars. The reason we like Bloomberg Analytics is it goes with current data, cash flow, sales, and things like that, and it re-rates the bonds based on current circumstances. And this was very advantageous. A number of years ago, we bought a bond by T-Mobile. It was rated by the agency at the time when they did their takeover. I think they issued about $5 billion of debt, and they were rated below investment grade. Well, 3 years later, when we bought it, because of increased income, they were moving towards investment grade, and eventually that's what happened. They got investment grade, and eventually they called that bond. But we were able to get a high yield return on that bond, and then also we were able to buy it at a discount. So that's the one thing that we like about Bloomberg Analytics, and it's one thing that, you know, if you do have a bond portfolio out there and you aren't really monitoring this, or you have a lot of money, we just took over an account for a major company. They had a considerable amount in bond funds. And when we analyzed them, we found that three of the funds where they were losing money were leveraged bond funds, meaning that the bond fund manager borrowed money to invest in bonds. And why would they do that? Well, if you can borrow at 1% and invest it at 3%, obviously you can increase the yield. And this had a high yield, but it works in reverse when interest rates are going up. So we can analyze bond funds or analyze your bonds using Bloomberg Analytics. And if you'd like to get a analysis of where your bond portfolio is, or if you have a substantial amount in bond funds, you know, we can analyze that for you. But you should be doing it yourself or with your advisor and take taking a look at this because, you know what, the credit agencies don't upgrade their credit. The only thing they do is maybe downgrade a company, and usually by the time they downgrade it, it's too late. And that's why we found Bloomberg Analytics is more looking at the future and where we are now than looking backwards. And it's one of the tools that we use.
You know, it's a little spooky here, like deja vu, because we have indeed been here before. I mean, look at what's happening here. You have loose credit standards, and then Congress has been deregulating things. It's always interesting how they have a crisis, and they put in regulation or laws that say, we'll never allow this to happen again, and then they undo that at some time in the future. Low interest rates, encouraging risk-taking, and then higher debt levels. So all of this put together, what are the odds we're going to have another crisis like we had 2007-2008, which could be worse than the one we had then?
Well, I mean, the forces that could lead to another financial crisis are still at work today. Number one, there's ample flows of money and capital across borders. And where this may come into play is emerging markets, which have borrowed, you know, over $1 trillion in U.S. dollars. So if the dollar was to reverse and start to increase in value as it did in the last financial crisis as a flight to safety, that would cause a financial crisis. We have mounting debt levels at all levels of government, municipal, state, sovereign debt. And you remember, it wasn't too long ago, back in 2011, when we had a debt crisis in Europe because of mounting debt levels in Greece and some of the peripheral countries. Number three, corporations and households are at record levels of debt. And number four, we are seeing ultra-low interest rates. Even though the Fed has raised, and maybe next week it'll be the sixth time, we're still only looking at a federal funds rate of 1.75%, and we're looking at treasuries at around the 3% level. So we still have low interest rates that would encourage risk-taking to borrow money, leverage, and take an inordinate amount of risk, and we know what happens eventually, that risk gets exposed. The other thing, too, is we have regulatory efforts. So, you know, we have put some things in place. The banks have a larger buffer of capital to absorb losses. They have larger capital reserves, and they've been restricted on the amount of trading in compensation that they could use with executives to encourage them to take risk. However, recently the Bank of International Settlements pointed out that one of the dangers that we have here is the bond markets have replaced, in many ways, bank credit. And bank credit is being regulated, of course, by the Fed and by government, but the bond market isn't. You know, as long as there's capital floating out there looking for a home, people are going to tap the bond market. Emerging markets have borrowed a ton of money. U.S. debt levels are at 250% of GDP. China has a greater amount of debt. And the question is, can they have a soft landing? If you look at corporate debt, it is now 34% of total assets. So right now, the ability to borrow at low rates keeps this crisis at bay. However, that won't always be the case. Do you know what everyone wants? Everyone wants the ability to retire and live well. Sounds easy, but it isn't. It requires careful planning. That is something not everyone knows how to do, and you may need help to plan, implement, and monitor your progress, assessing where you are now and where you want to be in the future. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. And unlike many advisors who sell you products you don't need, at Financial Sense Advisors, we are fiduciaries, which means we put your interest first. We do well when you do well.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
I think that February, and we were pounding the table in February saying that this was a great opportunity to deploy capital into the market. So we're holding fast on that. Outside of equities, I am interested in mean reversion in the bond market. I think that, again, you know, expectations for growth are at the high end. Expectations for inflation, I think, are definitely at the high end. I think that the bond market has absorbed all of that smart money. Commercial traders in treasuries are looking for yields to decline. You know, it has not happened yet. I'll be the first to admit that. But it is certainly set up for weakness, I think. And I think that's going to be a good opportunity. It's something that we're watching very, very, very closely right now.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. In the last segment, we discussed the possibility of the next financial crisis, the Fed being apt on raising rates because they have confidence in the economy and they feel they can raise rates with no problems now. The real question is, this all depends on how far they can go. And before Mr. Powell came in, we heard Janet Yellen always saying that the Fed was data dependent. Jim, I know you track the LEIs, leading economic indicators, talking about data. What are they telling you about the state of the economy? Also bearing in mind, by the way, that the Fed usually gets its economic predictions wrong.
Well, you know, John, if we look, obviously, we've got a couple more weeks here before we end the first quarter. So what's really going to be important is what happens in March as we look back over the 3 months since the beginning of the year. But we do have our latest up to date. Many of these indicators are basically January and February. So we're pretty much up to date. But, you know, we look at 20 to 30 of these things, not only here, but also internationally. And it's amazing because the one thing that it is showing, it's what the Fed said. Hey, I'm more confident of the economy going forward. Why? Well, number one, we just got a massive tax stimulus. Number two, the government's going to increase spending by an additional $200 billion a year. And already they're talking about two additional stimulus packages. They're talking about round two of tax cuts, and they're talking about fiscal stimulus. So let's just take a quick look. I mean, if we take a look at the Chicago Fed's National Activity Index, it has been trending down since November. It peaked in October, and it's been trending down November, December, and January. But once again, it's still in positive territory. Nonetheless, it is beginning to weaken. If we take a look at the Conference Board's consumer confidence, is at one of the highest levels that we've seen since 2000. And why that's important? Consumers are confident. What are they going to do? They're more apt to borrow. They're more apt to spend money. They're bringing down their savings rate to increase or continue to spend money. So right now, that's supportive of consumption. We take a look at the Conference Board's leading indicators, and that has been on an upward trek, and it's been doing that since September of last year. So that is positive as things are beginning to pick up there. We look at construction spending, that slowed down in the month of January, but typically you do see that because of weather-related events. I mean, just think of some of the storms that we saw, the Northeasters that we saw at the beginning of the year. Construction spending, if we take a look at the ECRI, weekly leading index, and ECRI, by the way, thinks that, you know, by the end of this year, we are more likely headed towards a recession. But right now, that index is in positive territory. It increased from 149.3 to the latest week of 149.7. So that's on a positive track. Existing home sales have been falling. And you would expect it. But, you know, some of that when, in fact, you might want to listen to our show coming up next Tuesday when I interview Rick Sharga as we take a look at the real estate market. Part of the problem is you got greater demand right now. And simply a lot of these construction companies and home builders just can't find the workers to put out the inventory. And, you know, if you're a home builder and you're seeing the Fed raising interest rates and you're hearing the Fed saying, hey, we're going to raise three more times. What are you thinking as a home builder? Are you going to want to build a whole bunch of inventory and just put it out on the market when you know eventually mortgage rates now are close to 4.5%? So, you know, look for some caution on the home front. So two of the big areas of consumption, homes and cars, we're starting to see some weakness. Factory orders were down in the recent survey in January, but remain positive overall. So, you know, I wouldn't put much behind that. Industrial production, is starting to increase. So that has ticked up, and that's good. Manufacturing jobs, you keep hearing about the president talking about trying to revitalize manufacturing in this country, and that seems to be at least supporting that. Two very big surveys, the ISM Manufacturing Index and the ISM Service Index, all ticking up, are almost record highs for the ISM. But here's what's important, and this gets back to this inflation idea. They have a prices paid component. Last July for the ISM manufacturing, it was at 62. And the latest survey in February, it was at 74.2. So we're seeing prices start to rise in manufacturing. If we take a look at the non-manufacturing index, still at a very, very high level. However, the prices paid component has gone from 55 to 61. And this is a trend we're starting to see. If we take a look at the Kansas City Fed survey, it is ticking up. But along with it, prices for raw materials have gone from 20 to the recent report in February to 50. So we're starting to see inflation start to build in the pipeline. If we take a look at the NAHB housing market index, that is still in favorable territory. Looking at some of the other Fed surveys, Empire State Manufacturing Index, that has been ticking up. Once again, a pattern we're starting to see in Fed surveys, regional surveys, ISM, the prices paid component has gone from 31 last August to 50.3 in its latest survey. Here's one to keep your eye on. And this is one a lot of people are saying, well, too early to tell yet. We've seen a weakness in retail sales. Now, will that continue? That's one to keep your eye on because 70% of this economy is you and I as consumers. We take a look at the Richmond Fed survey. That has been ticking up since last summer. Now, here's one, and this goes along with what we're seeing in Congress with the loosening of regulations. The U.S. Senior Loan Officer survey shows a moderate net percentage of banks that are easing their lending standards for commercial and industrial loans to large and medium firms in the fourth quarter. Also, lenders are reporting stronger demand for credit. So more credit going into the economy, that could be inflationary. Texas manufacturing is just skyrocketing. A lot of that is reflecting what's going on in the oil sector in Texas. Once again, prices paid component has gone from 26 to almost 40. And here's one to keep your eye on along with housing. U.S. vehicle sales were tracking last year around annual production or sales of about 18 million. That's down by 1 million, down to 17.1. And I suspect that would continue to decline as rates go up. And of course, as this cycle has matured. So John, once again, we're data dependent, but right now it shows us as we look at all these surveys and LAIs and also internationally, it's full steam ahead. The economy is likely to increase going forward. And especially it usually is its strongest quarter of the year are usually the second and third quarter of the year as we look at this business cycle. So I would expect to see economic growth pick up, which will do a number of things. Inflation will start to pick up as we're starting to see because we're watching import prices. We're watching the prices paid component in all these surveys. They're all ticking up and some by 40 and 50% from where they were at the end of the summer last year, in the beginning in the fall. And as that begins to pick up and as economic growth picks up, that will probably give the Fed more confidence to raise again in June when it's widely expected the second rate increase will come. Now, what happens by the time we get to summer, when we get the Fed funds rate at 2%, will the Fed kind of lay back and say, all right, we've raised it twice. Let's just watch the economic data over the next 3 or 4 months and see what happens before they have the confidence as they did last December when the economy really picked up steam last September and we really began to see the economy pick up. And so the Fed went ahead in December. Will they be cautious this time and raise rates in June and sit back? Well, a lot of it will depend on the things we just covered right now. Data-dependent economic data. Because if this was to begin to roll over, let's say by summer, this began to roll over. Then watch a different outcome coming from the Fed. But right now, it's full steam ahead. And once again, that's we're going to have to rely on a lot of this, as the Fed will, because they'll keep raising. As long as the economy is picking up and inflation is picking up, they'll only hold back and soften or maybe get more cautious when these indicators begin to roll over. And a lot of times it's a question of confidence. And many times after they're done raising, it's usually one rate hike too far. The damage is already done and we're rolling over. And somewhere somebody has been over leveraged, overextended, gets caught, and we have a financial crisis. Probably this time it could be coming from overseas.
So as we know from history, if they follow the same pattern at the Fed, they're going to keep raising things, saying that everything looks good right now until something actually breaks. But for right now, it looks like everything's pretty good. And as we're tracking all of this, as the time marches forward, coming up in the weeks ahead, what are we looking towards?
Well, next week, the FOMC will meet where it's widely expected. The Fed will raise interest rates a quarter of a point for the sixth time. But what's going to be important about next week's meeting is it'll be Powell's first press conference following the meeting, but also the Fed updates its economic projections for the year, its dot plot, and everybody's going to look at that very closely to say, did anything change? Are they moving that dot plot upward? In other words, indicating that we could possibly get four rate hikes. So next week is going to be a big week for the markets with the FOMC meeting. And then, of course, in the next 2 weeks, we will be ending Q1. And, of course, we're going to get pre-announcements on earnings, and we will be in the Q1 earnings season in earnest next month. So a lot of stuff here to talk about and track. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.